From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Greg Bluestein. Today, on the eve of Donald Trump's visit to Atlanta for a major fundraising event, we'll talk with Georgia Republican Party Chairman Josh McCoon about the state of Trump's campaign here in Georgia. We'll also ask how he thinks voters here will react to Trump's assertion that limits on abortion should be made by states, and much more.
I'm Patricia Murphy. Then we'll be joined by Stephen Owens, who's leaving his job at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute over what he calls cruel decisions lawmakers have made about transgender students in Georgia's public schools.
I'm Bill Nigut, plus Patricia will fill us in on what she learned when she attended Marjorie Taylor Greene's town meeting in Tunnel Hill last night.
We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents...
Hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny...
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at AJC.com/hip-hop.
Welcome to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia, setting the stakes in the agenda for Georgia politics every weekday morning at 10 a.m. I'm Greg Bluestein, along with Patricia Murphy and Bill Nigut here in studio. But it's great to see you.
Yeah, I especially took a shower this morning, Greg.
And I have been off for a couple of days, but I hope our listeners got to see at least, if not a full eclipse, at least a partial eclipse. We get to cover a lot of tough stuff, but it was really neat seeing all the coverage of something that we can all count as a collective shared celestial experience.
I didn't know Greg was a poet, Patricia.
Oh, I've known that a long time.
Oh, okay.
I know, but I got to go to my kids' school for the eclipse. Miss Rao said I could come watch it with them. It was so wonderful. It was wonderful to have teachers sort of telling everybody exactly what they were looking at, and people just were delighted with it. I just thought it was a really special moment.
My oldest kid was off school, and she spent the hour before the eclipse walking to the local mall. So I had to remind her, there's an eclipse going on, so bring your glasses. So she got to see it, though. So, folks, Donald Trump is coming back to town, and he's racing to catch up to President Biden's fundraising advantage. We're already seeing that edge being deployed here in Georgia. Biden's campaign just announced it was opening a sweep of offices across the state and hiring more staffers. Trump's campaign hasn't yet issued its own ground game strategy in Georgia. Instead, it's relying on the state Republican Party and other allies. So we're here now with Chairman Josh McCoon, who is the leader of the state Republican Party, to talk a little bit more about Donald Trump's campaign in Georgia and the big fundraising event tomorrow. Chairman McCoon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to be with you all this morning.
Well, Chairman McCoon, let's get right to it. Are there concerns among Republicans that Georgia Democrats are building on this early cash advantage? Donald Trump has outraised Joe Biden in the state of Georgia, but nationally, he's far, far behind him. And we're already seeing the sort of fruits of that labor from Democrats here in Georgia.
Yeah, no, we're not worried. If you look at what has happened since March 8th, when we installed the new RNC leadership, March 2024 was a $65 million month for the RNC. To put that in some perspective for your listeners, the RNC had $9 million in cash on hand at the end of the year. So we're seeing exactly what I expected we would see once Donald Trump wrapped up the primary nomination. A lot of your traditional Republican mega donors are coming home, are supporting the president and supporting the RNC. You're seeing that at the event that's coming up later this week with folks like Bernie Marcus, Senator Loeffler, and other key Republican funders who are doing what they need to do to give us the resources we need to win.
Josh, what kind of resources do you think y'all are going to need? Because both the RNC and the Georgia GOP are kind of doing double duty in terms of what you guys are paying for. You're paying for immense legal bills for either President Trump and some of the GOP members who were wrapped up in the case here in Fulton County. But then you also have got to have a ground game. You got to have ads on TV. What kind of fundraising do you need to be doing? Do you need to double it if you're sort of doubling what you're using it for?
Well, the good news is on the litigation front, outside of election-related litigation, which we could talk about separately, I believe the Court of Appeals is going to take up the application that's been filed. That will largely put the brakes on the case that D.A. Willis has been pursuing. I suspect she'll be disqualified along with her office, and then I expect to sue Fulton County and get our money back. But as far as the rest of our equation goes, the RNC is fully committed to supporting us. We're seeing very good support from our donor community. We had an event with Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana last month that was extremely well attended. A lot of support continues to come into the party. So I feel very good that we're going to have the resources we need to win in November.
Josh, there's been reporting by other news organizations about the reluctance of some previous Trump donors to get too involved in the campaign at this point because they fear that a good portion of what they give is going to go to pay Trump legal bills. Are you hearing that from any of your donors here in Georgia? Or for that matter, are people willing to give money and allow some of it to go to pay the legal bills?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is a subset of the donor community that says, look, this attempt to criminalize the political process has to stop, and I'm wanting to help any way I can. So we've had a lot of support, at least here in Georgia. Again, I think the proof as far as the RNC goes is you just look at the March numbers. I mean, these are record-breaking numbers in terms of money coming in. The event in Palm Beach over the weekend was a record breaker in terms of single event fundraising. This is not a new issue with Democrats outraising Republicans on a national level. That's happened in multiple cycles. I tell people, in politics, fundraising, it's kind of like in a poker game. You need enough to be at the table. And President Trump's going to have more than enough to be at the table and to do what he needs to do to prosecute the case against Joe Biden.
We're here with Chairman Josh McCoon of the Georgia Republican Party. But Chairman McCoon, to Bill's point, I feel like tomorrow is going to give us a glimpse of the hierarchy of the Trump infrastructure in Georgia. And there still is a split because we'll see former Senator Kelly Loeffler, we'll see former Senator David Perdue, we'll see probably you, a lot of your allies, but we won't see Governor Brian Kemp. We won't see Attorney General Chris Carr. We won't see other more establishment-friendly Republicans at that event. Is this ongoing rift, especially given the fact that Governor Kemp has started his own political network that he's using, maybe not to compete with the Georgia GOP, but to do things that he felt the Georgia GOP used to do and isn't doing. Is that ongoing rift still something that concerns you?
No, I think that Republicans are coming together. I mean, the governor has been very clear about where he is on the presidential race. I told people, 8 years ago, Democrats were already doing this. They had a lot of third party organizations and the Republican Party was kind of the sole player on the field. So I welcome the fact that we've got the governor's organization, that we've got Greater Georgia, that we've got Turning Point Action, that we've got a lot of groups that didn't exist a few years ago who are helping us marshal our forces so that we can be successful in the November election. This is not division, it's addition. It's more players on the field. It's more resources that are being spent on turning out Republicans, identifying low propensity Republican voters and getting them to the polls. So that's all positive.
Let's talk a little bit about the issues that are going to be on the table, particularly among the voters that Brian Kemp was able to pick up in 2022 that really seemed to make a big difference for him. Some of those more moderate, more independent voters or even moderate Republicans. The issue of abortion continues to come up over and over. And President Trump laid out a newish position, at least a final position, it sounds like, on the issue yesterday when he said he really thinks it ought to be left up to the states. But we're hearing from even conservatives who don't feel like that goes far enough. How do you see him and the party navigating this issue. You need those moderates, but then you've got to have the enthusiasm from your pro-life conservatives.
And Chairman, before you answer that, let's play that audio from Donald Trump just yesterday on his social media platform, True Social.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state.
Chairman?
So first of all, I would say Governor Kemp, as you noted, won a strong reelection in 2022 with a key part of his first term agenda being a significant restriction on abortion in Georgia. And obviously that wasn't an issue for voters that voted for him by a very large margin. I think that when you hear President Trump and what he just said, he's expressing the view of a lot of Republicans that the objection to Roe versus Wade was the codification of a national rule on abortion by an unelected Supreme Court. And, you know, there are Republicans, obviously, that agree, disagree on this issue. But I think that most people that I talk to, this is not the issue that they are activated about this campaign. I've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of people since June the 10th of last year. And I've not had a single person say to me, Josh, my vote in this election is going to be on the abortion politics of Joe Biden or Donald Trump. As a practical matter, we're not going to see national legislation on abortion because of the Senate. You're not going to get to a 60 vote threshold as a practical matter. This campaign, this election is going to be decided on the economy, on the border, on the foreign policy of this administration. It's about people feeling safe and secure economically and physically. That's what this election will be about.
Josh, you certainly have seen the reporting that any number of people in the so-called pro-life movement are disappointed, feel betrayed, that the former president did not take a stronger position on a national abortion ban or serious restrictions. You heard Senator Lindsey Graham say that he was disappointed in the way Trump is now positioned himself on the issue, and Trump fired back with his usual rage when someone disagrees with him. While it's certainly probably true that there aren't going to be many people who would otherwise have voted for Trump who suddenly will not support him in the election, when Trump said in his statement that he's tired of seeing Republicans lose political contests over the issue of abortion, it's another example, it feels to me, of the transactional nature of the way Trump, over his entire career, has approached abortion. Are you convinced he is truly anti-abortion, given his changing position over the years?
Look, this president promised in 2016 to appoint justices to the U.S. Supreme Court that would examine closely Roe versus Wade, and he delivered on that promise. And now it's up to Republicans around the country. I was a state legislator for 8 years. We've got to make the case about a culture of life. We've got to make a case about making adoption easier in the states. We've got to demonstrate that we care about children, not just at the time they are born, but for their entire lives. That's what the challenge is for Republicans around this country if we want to make real progress on abortion, on the abortion issue. This is going to be a public policy debate that's in 50 different locations. It's going to be in state capitals. The president is recognizing that political reality, and I don't blame him for recognizing that political reality. We need to do a better job at the state level. We saw it in Ohio in the referendum up there. Senator Vance spoke to that issue. Republicans have got to do a better job about the alternatives and about the culture of life that we all firmly believe in.
Just a quick follow-up. Let's give a hypothetical here. Let's say we have a Republican Congress that decides to, in fact, support and pass legislation imposing a national abortion ban of some limited time period. It gets to the president, that Donald Trump's assuming his election desk. Are you suggesting that his statement would preclude him from signing a national abortion ban?
I'm saying that that's just not going to happen. I mean, I live in the real world, Bill, and in the real world, the U.S. Senate that's going to exist in 2025 is not going to have 60 votes for any abortion legislation in either direction. It's not going to happen. So I think that's why the president is saying that, because why are we going to talk about this academic question when it's never going to confront whoever the next president is?
Fair enough.
We're here with Georgia Republican Party Chairman Josh McCoon. From me, Chairman, one more question on this topic. You just mentioned that you don't see many conservatives being animated by this issue, that they'll be more concerned about the economy, public safety, other issues that we've seen dominate past election cycles. But certainly Democrats have seen the opposite. You know, in Georgia, that message might not have been the top message in 2022, but certainly we've seen candidates who tried to make it one of their top priorities of expanding abortion right access, reversing Georgia's 2019 anti-abortion law. And they'll be trying to do that again in 2024, particularly to those swing voters that we've seen are so decisive in Georgia, at least in 2020, 2021, and 2022. Those maybe we call them the Kemp Warnock voters, those split ticket voters. So what's the message to them from Republicans, to those women who are and men who are independent, but support abortion rights and are worried that Republicans would try to either preserve anti-abortion measures or try to roll them back in other parts of the country?
Well, I think the message is that the election for president of the United States is not going to in any way change the law on abortion in the state of Georgia. That is a matter for the Georgia General Assembly. It's a matter for our governor. And again, the people I'm talking to are a lot more worried about the economy, people that have lost full-time jobs that are working two or three part-time jobs to make up for it. People are very concerned about the southern border. Obviously, the situation with Lake and Riley, other situations similarly around the country. People are very concerned about two hot wars in Ukraine and the Middle East and China looming as a threat to this country. Those are all things that I think people are a lot more concerned about than this academic question of what a president may or may not do. And again, here in Georgia, we had our governor in the first legislative session of his first term pass one of the most robust protections of life anywhere in the country. And as y'all pointed out, he was decisively reelected in 2022. And that's been tried before in Georgia. I just don't think it is going to have any currency with the voting public. They're going to be concerned about these other issues I've been discussing.
Well, we certainly noticed during the 2022 campaign that Governor Kemp didn't talk very much about abortion ahead of November. Concerns I hear from Republicans is that President Trump, by putting this statement out there, has brought it back up, and he feels like it's kind of a loser of an issue for Republicans in a general election. One last question about abortion. I know you're ready to move on, but one last question. You said you wanted to talk about the alternatives to abortion. Do you think women don't know about their alternatives right now?
I think we make it entirely too difficult to adopt a child in this state. I think that we should be looking for ways to make it less expensive for people to exercise that choice. I think that we need to do everything we can to demonstrate that there are additional supports in our public policy for adoption. I'm not saying that people aren't aware of the fact that carrying a child to term and offering the child for adoption is not an alternative for them. I'm saying that we can make that process easier. We can make it easier for the adoptive parents to adopt. I know that's something that Governor Kemp's talked about. It's something that's been talked about in the General Assembly. You've seen Republicans do that around the country. So that's what I'm saying when I refer to improving public policy on those issues.
Chairman McCoon, I want to turn now to state politics, because you took an extraordinary step the other day, last week, in calling for the first vice chair of the state Republican Party, Brian Pritchard, to step down after a judge found that he voted illegally 9 times in 2008. He is fighting the charges, and there's a hearing in May now to potentially remove him. But why did you take that step?
So when we were all elected last June, this complaint was pending against our first vice chairman. And at the time, I said, look, no one's ruled on this. A judge hasn't heard this. Let's give him the opportunity to mount his defense and have his day in court. I believe in that as a lawyer. So we waited patiently for him to have the hearing in front of Judge Boggs. He's had years to prepare his defense. And then the defense, as I understand it, essentially was, I didn't realize what I did was wrong. Now, I don't know about y'all, but in my house, I think my parents stopped letting me get away with that excuse when I was 5 or 6 years old. You know if something's wrong. You know if you're a felon that you should probably check on the laws in your state about whether or not you're going to be registered to how you're going to register to vote. And so this was wildly irresponsible. It is, if we are going to talk about election integrity as a party, we cannot have people in our leadership that have shown such disregard for the election integrity laws of the state. And so I met with him privately. I asked him to resign. I called on him to resign publicly. And unfortunately, he's resisted those calls. So on May the 10th, our state committee will be meeting to determine whether or not he'll be removed from office.
And Chairman, this is also somewhat new ground for the party. Are you confident he'll be removed, or is this kind of a mystery of what will happen next?
I feel very confident he will be removed because the vast majority of Georgia Republicans take voting very seriously and take our election integrity laws very seriously. I'm sorry that Mr. Pritchard did not, but you know, we've got to move on. We've got to talk about the issues that we've been talking about with you most of our time this morning. We don't need to be talking about why a member of our leadership did not follow Georgia law with regard to registering to vote and participating in elections.
Well, Chairman McCoon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you all for having me.
When we come back, a longtime education advocate at the state capitol explains why he's called it quits. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from me and the rest of the AJC politics team. Just go to AJC.com/newsletters and sign up today. AJC.com/newsletters. I'm Greg Bluestein, here in studio with Bill Nigut and Patricia Murphy. Guys, every year at the legislature, we tend to focus on the lawmakers who propose and debate and vote on bills. But there's a core of lobbyists and analysts who help shape that debate every year. And for the last 6 years, Stephen Owens has been one of them. That is, until the end of the session, where he declared he had had enough. Stephen now joins us on Politically Georgia. Thanks for joining our team.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, so before we get into why you quit, tell us about your job for the last 6 years at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Tell us about what you did, what you tried to do over your six-year term there.
Yeah, tried to do is apt. I was the education director at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that believes that the budget is a moral document. We tried to show like the true cost of a lot of the policies that were being proposed, and we proposed a Georgia where all people prosper, and that meant looking at the budget, who's being kept behind, who is able to profit from the state's resources. And in K-12 public schools, it looked like trying to supply a strong, excellent, diverse public education system where folks are compensated for their work, where students are given the opportunities they need to succeed inside of every one of Georgia's schools. So a lot of data research analysis, a lot of technical assistance, and then sometimes direct lobbying for policies that we felt like helped or hurt the state.
And Dr. Owens, shortly after Sine Die, basically time to call Sine Die yourself and call it quits. One of the things you wrote was that as a Christian, you felt betrayed by lawmakers, that you became, I'm quoting here, bitter and fearful, and began to put my faith in my own ability to change things for the better. I began to question my own faith and my own ability to change things for the better. Talk about how you came to that conclusion.
It's not a new thought to watch folks use your faith in a way that you're not comfortable with. And I know I'm not the only person that feels that on either side of the aisle. I will say the past few years, it has gotten, darker in the Georgia General Assembly. Just meaner is going to be the most elementary way I can put it. And I saw a lot of people using the faith that I grew up in, that I still call my own, as a reason to selectively choose parts of the Bible to impose across the entire state, with very little talk of the graciousness that I would see in the Christian faith. And that was not something that just I experienced. The number of people who've reached out afterwards across the political spectrum who said that they felt the exact same way, that it's hard to watch Christianity only being used as a way to restrict people with no talk of God's graciousness. That personally, I took that really personally.
Stephen,
go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize, but I think I want to take you to the next step, which is talk about specific pieces of legislation that led you to this conclusion.
I think that the emphasis on immigration and the way that we talk about people, the way that we talk about people that in my faith tradition says are made in God's image, the way that we talked about children that if they don't identify with their gender assigned at birth, as if they're somehow less than, if they deserve the cruelty given to them by other children, by adults, what happens is there's a human cost, even if some of the worst bills don't get across the line, there's a human cost of sitting in those rooms and hearing two duly elected lawmakers talk about people this way and forward legislation that'll make life more cruel for them.
So, Stephen, I think these are conversations that you must be having inside your church as well, I would assume, because we certainly hear from Christian conservatives who do use their religion, who cite the Bible directly when they're pushing forward some of these culture war issues. But it seems like it's a conversation that's happening within the church as well, that that it's not just in the General Assembly, but that is where we see it on full display.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's a difference between beliefs and values, that that we can have this difference of opinion on the application of these policies, but our values have to stay somewhat together if we're going to be a part of a Christian community. And I think that's a sign of a healthy church, that we're having these discussions where we might not all agree on ways to alleviate poverty, but this recognition that poverty is an evil that needs to be alleviated. That's not the way that this world should operate. And so you're absolutely right that there's going to be these good faith discussions. What I saw a lot in the General Assembly was not some good faith discussions. I felt like folks were lobbying as ways to how can we make it clear that we think this person and this thing is wrong, regardless of the practical implications and the human cost of it.
When this year did it become clear to you? We certainly saw the debate after Laken Riley was killed in Athens. That really kicked up a conversation about immigration that simply was not happening at the Capitol before she was killed. We continued to see bills about transgender students. What was the moment for you where you said, I just can't do this anymore?
There were two. And again, a lot of this is due to my own inability to separate my work from my emotional health, right? I took a lot of this personally. But one was, and I can't remember the exact bill number, but it was Amari Crawford's bill in the Senate Education Committee that was supposed to be about mental health and athletes, and became this vehicle to target the bathrooms that trans children use and a number of other what we call kind of culture war bills, sex education, limiting when folks can talk about sex education. And another was
that was HB 1104, by the way, it was a suicide prevention bill that turned into an anti-transgender measure.
Absolutely. You know, I'm 1 week away from it and I've already forgotten all these bill numbers. It's kind of nice. And another was just the debate about the American Library Association, that you saw this thing that seemed like it was above reproach. And a lot of the reason behind restricting any public funds from going to the ALA was around where it was housed in New York. There was a lot of talk about being from New York and California and Chicago, and it was so devoid of serious policy discussions. And that's one thing I've missed in the past few years. I feel like we've lost a lot of our serious lawmakers that took their work seriously. And it feels a lot more like, how can we feed red meat to the imaginations of our base? Well, and that, for those of us who did work in kind of serious policy areas, it takes a toll.
Stephen, when did you start seeing that change? You've been down there for a long time. You've certainly watched legislatures where there've been fighting among, you know, members over particular bills. But it seems to me that you're suggesting the tone and tenor has changed dramatically in more recent years. When do you think it all changed, and what do you attribute the coarseness now and the what you feel is an almost obscene and immoral behavior by some lawmakers in terms of the issues they bring forward? When did that change?
I think there's a number of things, but it's hard not to tie a lot of this to 2020 and the election. Specifically in education, though, the closing of schools changed a lot of people's perspectives of how they wanted to treat public education. They saw it as, or treated it legislatively as something that needed to be punished, that needed to be corrected, versus a responsibility of the state to maintain and cultivate. And the election, I talked to serious lawmakers who knew for a fact that the election was not stolen, but had no problem signing on their names saying, this is something that my constituents want. So there's no problem. It's not going to get overturned, but I'm going to just do that because it's something that my constituents want. Watching that divorce from truth was really painful from people that I respected. And then, of course, the school closures and COVID made it. There were institutions that felt like lawmakers treated as if they needed to be punished, whether or not those institutions were responsible for some of the cost of the pandemic in schools.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Owens, a longtime analyst at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, who recently called it quits, frustrated with what he said was a betrayal of Christian values and other values at the Georgia Capitol after this past legislative session. And Dr. Owens, look, even so, many of the culture wars measures that you proposed, that you opposed didn't make it to Governor Kemp's desk, as you mentioned earlier, let alone become law. That includes the two measures that you just talked about as sort of the defining points that help shape your decision to leave. So do you take solace that they didn't get much traction beyond the Georgia Senate this past session?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that they didn't make it across the line. But again, as someone whose job was to meet with these lawmakers, to sit in these meetings, to talk with the parents while their kids are grappling with what their lawmakers have said, there was a daily cost to that. And at some point, you look at these and say, sure, the worst of the worst didn't get across the line. But it's not written in stone that it's always going to be that way. Eventually, some of these things are going to get across. And even not in the worst of the worst, but the way that we look at it as policy analysts, we need a legislature that cares about the details, that cares about the numbers. And you feel like you lose a lot of those folks over years if they feel like they have to say the most outlandish thing to stand out in their party.
You have been very vocal on your way out the door. You wrote a really terrific op-ed in the AJC, but you have not minced words. You haven't named names, but you have not minced words. Have you heard from lawmakers since you announced your decision? And also, what have your coworkers said?
I have heard from lawmakers, and I think it's a similar sentiment. It's a little bit of a lament for the way they viewed being, a policymaker, and then what it looks like in the Gold Dome daily, the difference between what it looks like to have conversations with reasonable people and then what's being said from the well, what's happening in committee meetings. I think it makes it really hard for those lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who actually aren't trying to get rich, who just want to make the state better. Mm-hmm. To feel like they're getting pushed into these fights that are so different from the day-to-day experience from Georgians, and similar to coworkers, that it's just it's hard to follow this along, and feel like your work of following the data and the research falls apart if a really good anecdote comes up that destroys kind of all your good work. And a lot of that's been true for a long time. But at some point, when my entire year comes to like, oh, session is in 8 months, session is in 4 months, and it's kind of a countdown, you realize, okay, it's time for a change. And I'm not naming names because, again, this is not limited to one party. Republicans are in charge in Georgia. Democrats have not been gifted by God some otherworldly view of kind of human flourishing. But there is that responsibility that falls with the party that has been given that power over the state of Georgia. So I don't want to kind of cast one political party as solely responsible for this. But I understand those who would expect those more from the party that's in power when we see kind of our institutions that need more support and less time and attention put towards culture fights, is the way I'll say it.
So, Stephen, you obviously left with a certain sense of despair, but at the same time, you describe yourself as a Christian, which means you have to have hope, faith that things can at some point change. How do you imagine that we, all of us as people together, can change what's happened to our politics?
I think it's going to take time. And so, first of all, let me separate it a little bit. Jesus didn't say like, hey, once we get a new Caesar, things are going to be better. You know, there's very little like voting advice put into the Old and New Testament. But that doesn't mean that we don't act that out in our values as well as in the public sphere. And so I do have a hope that kind of sits outside the day-to-day workings of the Georgia General Assembly. I will say, zooming out, I still have a lot of faith in like the people of Georgia, this incredible state, and specifically in public education. 90% of students go there. Republicans and Democrats are very happy with their local school. If they have children in their local school, they still expect things from their legislators that I think will bear out in time. That doesn't mean that things won't be difficult for a while, but I believe that there's still plenty to be excited about. I mean, even in a really difficult session like this, we were able to secure $200 million additionally for school buses and for pupil transportation, which will make a real difference for public schools. So it's not all despair. And again, some of this is just how I process all of these things. I believe that we are going to have just this world-class education in the state of Georgia. It's just going to take calling out evil when we see it. We can't just pretend like this is just another run-of-the-mill session where people can like openly say lies and the most cruel things they can think of in order to garner an additional vote. Like, it takes a lot of us being able to say, no, that is actually terrible. What you just said is actually terrible. I don't want to give this kind of despair view on the way out. It's just that after a while, I realized that I couldn't be in the same position.
Dr. Owens, I want to ask you about that a little bit more, because it's an observation I've made after covering the legislature for the last two decades or so. 8 years ago, when Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed in Georgia, it was national news. It seemed like every single day there was uproar. There was a lot of criticism and protest against what critics call a thinly veiled piece of legislation that was aimed at discrimination, especially of LGBTQ groups. This year, when it passed, it barely seemed to make a blip in some ways. You know, are we becoming numb to some of the legislation that you and others oppose?
I think that's a really good way of putting it. I think at some point, the groups that push for policies like that called the bluff of those outside the Georgia General Assembly that said big changes will happen if you do this, right? And it's not just Georgia. It's North Carolina, Texas, other states that have kind of continued to push. And it's hard not to see a similar corollary in like President Trump's ability to call the bluff of people who said, if you do this, you have gone too far. And then when he does it, that there seems to be so few consequences on that, or at least that's the perception outside of his administration. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we've seen a lot of states do that. And RFRA was a great example of that here in Georgia that like all the things that supposedly were going to come to pass as consequences to pass something like that, maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe people really can push bad legislation and it just sits there and then we have to deal with the consequences on the other side versus it being projected out as this may come to pass.
Well, Dr. Owens, before we get the break, what's next for you? Have you decided what your next step is going to be yet?
I have. Thankfully, I was able to secure another job before leaving this one because I still need health insurance.
Turns out.
I am now the director of policy and advocacy at Brown's Promise, a new organization housed under the Southern Education Foundation to work on school integration, which I feel like is this next level of what resource equity and opportunity looks like in public education schools. And so we are working on campaigns right now in Colorado, Massachusetts, and Georgia to bring back what is shown to be the most successful education intervention ever studied in American public education, which is school integration.
Well, Dr. Owens, thanks for joining us and best of luck for what's ahead.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Patricia about her visit to a Marjorie Taylor Greene town hall in Northwest Georgia. This is Politically Georgia.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We've got a great offer for Politically Georgia listeners, and listen close, because this is the South's biggest deal. For a limited time, subscribe and you'll get digital access to the AJC for $1.99 per week for life. Subscribe right now by going to ajc.com/start. That's ajc.com/start. A great deal for an even greater Atlanta. This is for new subscribers only. I'm here with Bill Nigut and Patricia Murphy. And guys, we just had two guests who I feel like they couldn't be more divergent in their political views. Stephen Owens, formerly of the GBPI, the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, and Josh McCoon, the chairman of the Georgia Republican Party. But I feel like I learned a lot from both, Bill.
Yeah. No, it was really an interesting contrast. And Owens is really, to believe so deeply in the moral value of government, it's really a very powerful thing to think about, especially, you know, we deal with politics every day and we rarely put it in that context. But he's so right to say that that's really, in fact, important.
Yeah, Patricia, it was really interesting hearing from his perspective as someone who is a veteran of the Gold Dome and, you know, called it quits in such a public way. We often see analysts and lobbyists and lawmakers kind of, you know, say their farewells, but not in the way that Stephen Owens did.
Yeah, there's a lot of self-preservation on the way out the door of jobs like these, usually, because you don't want to burn the people that you've been working with. You don't want to burn bridges if you need help from somebody in the future. So it takes a real kind of courage to speak out this way. But I think he is a part of a larger and really disturbing trend of staffers who truly make the General Assembly function, make Capitol Hill function, of them saying, this is not the job I signed up for. There was a recent poll of senior staffers, chiefs of staff on Capitol Hill, and 50% of them said they are looking for new jobs or want to leave, that it's just not an environment that's healthy, it's not productive. And those members cannot afford to lose the staffers who know the policy, know the budget, know what they're talking about, and are incentivized to get things done, while the members are often incentivized not to get things done.
And we should remind our listeners, Patricia, you speak from experience because you're a former staffer on the Hill and you've probably seen it change. Even the years way back when you were a staffer on the Hill, you've seen things change.
Yeah, I left the Hill in 2003 because it was starting to get so partisan and so difficult. I didn't feel invested in the politics of the Hill. I felt invested in the policy outcomes. And I could just feel it was not aligning with who I was as a person. I just wasn't a partisan warrior. And that is what was starting to be required even back then. Now you talk to people who say they just don't trust their coworkers. They don't trust other members. They bang their heads against the wall that nothing is getting done after they work on these bills for 2, 3, and 4 years at a time. So I understand the frustration for sure.
Well, Patricia, speaking of partisan warriors, in the few minutes we have left, let's talk about the field trip you took to Marjorie Taylor Greene's backyard. You went to her town hall meeting in Tunnel Hill, Georgia. It was far from your first time to her district. I'm sure you've been there more than a dozen times easily since she was elected. I know the whole team at the AJC has been there plenty. But this is a particularly pivotal moment as she is once again rumbling about removing, or at least voting against, the House Speaker, Mike Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. And talk about partisan warriors. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is taking it to an entirely other level. She held this town hall for members of anybody who lives in her district could go. I was told about the event. I was told I could go. So that's why I went. And it was fascinating because she typically spends and has for her career spent so much time and effort hammering Democrats, talking about literally the evils of Democrats and what they're doing. And last night, she had kind of some grudging admiration for Democrats for being united and holding their own and getting things done or not done the way they wanted to. And she was ripping into Speaker Mike Johnson in a way that it's hard to see how she's not going to call for his ouster at some point. But I also talked to some of her constituents who weren't quite on board with that plan. Listen, many are on board, many love her. But they said, I love Marjorie Taylor Greene. I just don't see where this is going. What's the plan here? Is this going to work?
And Patricia, Marjorie Taylor Greene followed up this morning with basically an open letter outlining some of her concerns for the speaker that reminds us of just how tenuous the Republican grasp on that gavel is with just a few votes to spare.
Yeah, well, Republicans are actually losing members in the middle of this term, sitting members, Republican members of Congress, who just don't want to be there anymore. So every time a member leaves, that Republican majority gets smaller and smaller. So the dysfunction within the GOP is sort of eating the House GOP alive right now. And Mike Johnson has a margin of 2 to 3 votes. He cannot lose anybody besides Marjorie Taylor Greene without losing his job. And that's the conversation that she is pushing very hard right now.
Yeah, over a number of issues. The Capitol that we'll keep on watching. That's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can now hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 a.m. and 90.1 WABE in Atlanta. Or you can follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, we'd love if you leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I'm Ernie Suggs, race and culture reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
And I'm Ned Ravone, lifestyle columnist. Atlanta has been known as the Black Mecca for so many years, but that means something different to everybody.
It means everything to me. I've been living here for 24 years, and I am still amazed at how rich the city's Black culture continues to grow. Every day I wake up, I learn something new.
Well, you all can learn something new by subscribing to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new newsletter called Unapologetically ATL. It's all about the people, the events, and the entertainment happening in Metro Atlanta that Black people might want to know about.
Like historically Black colleges and universities.
Atlanta's thriving art scene.
And the city's growing neighborhoods.
Wherever you live, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what issues are important to you.
So subscribe today at www.ajc.com/unapologeticallyATL.
Only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.